We have talked about it endlessly over the last decade or so, and we've accomplished close to zip.
We know enough about our climate problem to know that it's serious and that we need to get started right away.
What we're seeing right now is a clear loading of the weather dice.
I'm Carrie Miller, and it's time for the ClimateCast. It's our weekly conversation about the science of climate change. Today, the climate deal in Paris got a lot of attention in 2015, but there were other significant climate and energy stories you might have missed. To talk about that, we've invited John Upton to the show. He's a senior science writer for Climate Central. Good morning, John. Good to have you on the show.
Good morning, Carrie. Thank you for having me.
So it seems like the lead up and then the 12-day climate conference in Paris sucked a lot of the climate oxygen in the newsrooms. But you've zeroed in on some different stories and policies that deserve some attention. And one of them is the Obama administration's pursuing of new rules for coal plants. Tell me why that's important. Why we should understand it better.
Well, the clean power plan that the Obama administration finalized this year actually ties in very closely with the Paris Agreement. It's quite a similar approach. The U.S. government is, for the very first time under the Clean Air Act, regulating the release of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Obviously, the Clean Air Act has been used to clean up America's air since the 1970s. This is the first time that will be used to actually slow down America's impacts on global warming.
Is it important that these are rules that did not have to be passed through Congress? Because I doubt whether they could have been.
It's very significant. I mean, the administration has been hobbled by Congress. It's limited in what it's been able to do to achieve anything, really, in its fight against climate change. But it's found a solution here, a very meaningful solution that will allow the U.S. government to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from the power sector for the first time. And they will be able to do that in a way that does not require any kind of permission or votes from Congress. So it's significant that the Obama administration has found a way of working around the kind of environmental obstructionism from Congress.
John, I'm trying to remember, while we're talking about coal and what a contribution it is to greenhouse gases globally, while the United States is making some progress on this, what about a country like China, which I know has committed to reducing emissions, I think, after, what is it, the year 2030? But there are parts of China that rely very heavily still on coal. What happens while we're reducing, but a country the size of China is not yet when it comes to coal?
Well, actually, China is arguably being more aggressive than the U.S. in recent years in trying to reduce pollution from coal. It's not being primarily driven by a concern for the climate, but by the absolutely awful air pollution problems that they've been experiencing there. You see similar trends elsewhere in the world. India is another major coal consumer, and it continues to build new coal power capacity. But this Paris Agreement starts to at least put some kind of a framework in place so that the individual efforts of these countries can, you know, be coordinated and hopefully guided through technology that comes from the West to help them reduce their reliance on coal and reduce the amount of pollution that they are putting into the atmosphere at their much earlier stages of development than the U.S. Is right now.
Okay. I see that Climate Central also put the end of the Keystone Pipeline on your list of big stories, energy and climate stories for 2015. Here's my question about that. Did the Keystone Pipeline really, the push for it end because of where oil prices are or because of the political opposition? Or, you know, is it a combination of both?
Oh, it's definitely a combination of both. But it's very significant that the first leg of Keystone, which is the southern leg, which reaches down into the Gulf, that was approved during Obama's first term. I believe construction of that is now complete. But the fact that the second leg has run into so much additional difficulty, I think, is a reflection of the times. And when the Obama administration announced that they were going to be rejecting the application to build the second leg, the upcoming Paris Agreement and the desire to fight global warming was explicitly mentioned by them. And it was around the same time that the Obama administration was also deciding not to allow oil companies to renew speculative drilling leases in Alaska. So what we saw over the last 12 months was suddenly, for the first time, the U.S. really getting serious about rejecting fossil fuel projects and mentioning climate change when it did so.
I noticed that you did not, Climate Central did not put the surprisingly and sustained low price of oil on your list as one of the big stories. Why is that?
Oh, I think that is a big story, but our focus at Climate Central is very specifically on climate science and, to a lesser extent, climate policy. But I think that the falling oil prices do present the world with an opportunity to start properly pricing carbon. And we have we're seeing a lot of countries and municipalities starting to actually implement carbon pricing and so forth, but not really taking advantage of the opportunity that's being presented right now by these low oil prices.
You don't see the U.S. really doing much policy-wise, though, to price carbon, do you? I mean, and you, of course, I'm thinking of a carbon tax or something like that.
Right. So the U.S. government, no. But the states are. There's about, nine states, mid-Atlantic states or East Coast states, that have RGGI. It's a carbon trading program that only affects the power industry. California has a very aggressive carbon pricing system, which it has started to link now with some international markets. And there's a lot of talk about carbon taxes or cap and trade systems in places such as Washington State, I think Oregon. So I think that while the U.S. government has not been in a position to introduce carbon pricing as a result of Republican opposition in Congress, you're seeing a number of states adopting it. The new power plant laws should actually and have been crafted to help push that forward.
You know, John, I was just thinking as I listened to you say that, that's kind of the story of a lot of the environmental change over the last perhaps decade, where in the absence of federal policy, anything getting through Congress, individual states, I mean, Minnesota has been a leader on renewables, California with what you've just talked about, the carbon tax. Is that significant to you, that the states are stepping up to do individual policy that may present a patchwork but is nonetheless important?
I think that it's absolutely critical, and I think that if you look even more locally at the city level, that's where you see the really aggressive steps being taken. The entire Paris Agreement is premised on the idea that it's proven pointless to try to tell governments what to do, and that now we need to be embracing this bottom-up idea where states and cities and nations are the breeding grounds for climate action, and that the Paris Agreement and the United Nations role there is to help unify those efforts.
John Upton is with us for the Climate Cast. He's a senior science writer for Climate Central, and they've put together a list here at the end of 2015 of some of the biggest energy and climate stories of the year. This is one that really surprised me because I clearly haven't been reading enough about this, the offshore wind industry. And you note on this list that the U.S. has long missed out on opportunities to generate electricity and power from offshore wind turbines, but it looks like that's changing. What's going on with that?
Well, if you travel to Europe, then you see some extraordinary offshore wind farms. They've got all these turbines sticking out of the water there. But for a number of reasons, which can be traced sometimes back to local opposition, there just has not been the momentum required in the U.S. to get these projects moving forward. They are very capital intensive. If you put wind turbines out in the ocean, then you also need to put a cable from land to those wind turbines. So it's an expensive undertaking, but in Europe it's proved very fruitful. And now we're starting to see in the U.S., finally, construction has actually begun on the first offshore wind farm, or just off Rhode Island. So that, you know, these things can really yield a lot of very clean energy. So it is exciting to see the U.S. finally belatedly moving in this direction.
Is it the cost, or has it been the aesthetics, or what is it that has, I mean, with as much coastline as the United States has, I'm confused as to why we've been late to this.
There has been opposition. There are upfront costs that developers are wary of wearing if this local opposition ends up killing their project. opposition has killed projects, but I also just simply don't think that it's been a priority of the federal or of any state governments, really. You've seen governments here focusing very clearly on solar and onshore wind farms, as, you know, particularly in the West and also the Midwest, where you see a lot of wind turbines sprouting on the land. But there simply hasn't been this awareness or there hasn't been a strong drive in the U.S. for offshore wind, and we're starting to see that very gradually change.
John, I thank you very much for being with us for the Climate Cast. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Kerry.
John Upton is a senior science writer for Climate Central.